Mind Radio with Alejandro.
Radio.
Open Minds Radio is your UFO news authority, presenting evidence and the latest news regarding the UFO phenomenon. Here's your host, Alejandro Rojas.
Hey, that's me, Alejandro Rojas, and you're listening to Open Minds Radio. Our intro by the Honorable, if you can say that, I'm not sure how you even get the title, Honorable Bob Dean, who always just sounds so wise, like he thinks out every word very carefully, which I don't. I should, because that's how you get in trouble when you don't think about what you're going to say very carefully. We have on the show today, and I'm so excited about it, Travis Walton. So luckily, I have known him for a few years now, and he's a very interesting fella. And if you've seen the movie Fire in the Sky, then you know who I'm talking about, which most of you probably have. And it's a story of Travis Walton, a gentleman who was with some buddies while he was logging, really coworkers, because they weren't all buddies. In fact, one of them, I guess, kind of, they didn't get along too well. When they went to go look at a UFO in the forest, and Travis decided to be cool and run out there, and it beamed him, and everybody freaked and ran, and he was essentially gone for 5 days. And I don't want to give away too much of the story, because we'll talk to Travis about that. But if you've seen the movie, it's all pretty accurate. It all sticks pretty close to what really happened, except for what happened on the ship, because it created this real dark, ugly environment on the ship where, you know, he was drug around this dirty area, and there were body parts and just all this ridiculous stuff. And that's not what he remembers happening at all. So we'll talk to him about what really happened and why the movie didn't portray what really happened, because I think that would have been more interesting. But Hollywood being the way it is, this is, you know, the home of reality television, and some of this Sookie, is that her name, the New Jersey Shore people and some of that awful stuff they have on TV. I don't think they always make the best decisions when they're choosing what they're going to do in Hollywood. But we'll talk about how that came about. And it's really interesting, especially what happened on the show. And you'll get a sense of what Travis is like, because if you haven't met him, and I know not many people have been able to meet him, he does speak in conferences. He hadn't been doing that much, but he has been doing that more lately. But you'll see he's a real down-to-earth person, just kind of your regular guy out there, which you would think, maybe a logger would be like. And I know living in Arizona, this happened in Arizona, not too far away. I now have met the guy who sold me my house. Essentially, it was a company that sold me my house, but the guy in charge of customer service, he was from the town that this happened at. And he said, you know, these are the type of people that they don't lie. Lying is very foreign to these guys. If they tell you something, it's the real deal. They're not kind of jokesters and everything. So I'm really excited to talk about Travis, and really excited to share some of what's happened to him with you all. I think you're going to find this all very, very interesting. And if you haven't seen the movie, you got to race out and see it. And if you have, maybe it'll inspire you to go watch it again. But we'll also talk about Travis's updated book, which goes over everything that happened here and how you will be able to get that book. So I'm very excited about this great show today. I hope everyone had some wonderful holidays. It's always nice to get so many days off and rest, and that's what I like. Of course, the traveling part isn't very restful. In fact, on the plane back from Colorado, my home, there is probably more children on this plane than I've ever experienced in my life. It was as if you were hanging out in the play area in a McDonald's. But luckily, I am a master meditator, and I was able to phase it all out. Unfortunately, other people were not, and it gets rough traveling during the holidays. So I recommend everybody, if you travel, practice some meditation. It'll help. Other things going on. Of course, we've got the radio show on High Definition on YouTube. Check that out. We're also putting new videos up there all the time. And thank you to some of our new subscribers on YouTube. We got a bunch over the holiday weekend, so a bunch of you must have been sitting by the computer checking out some of those videos, some very interesting UFO videos, some archival stuff from the Wendell Stevens archives that dates back to decades ago, but also some new stuff as well. In fact, you know, I'd love more input on this weird video that I got from these gentlemen who were in Las Vegas a couple years ago and got this just weird light that was kind of floating around the New York roller coaster and flying above the strip there. It was very strange. Check that out and see what you think there. And it's hard to even say it's UFO because it was flying, but it's almost ghostly, like a ghost cruising around above Las Vegas. That's scary. So very interesting video. Check that out. Of course, we've got the UFO Congress coming up here very, very soon, which it's another reason why it was good to have a few days off, because stress levels around here were getting pretty high before we went on vacation. And people, because of course I'm always very nice and polite to everyone, but people started being mean to me and snapping at me, and Jason threw a mug at my head and I barely dodged it because he was getting real frustrated. And I just, I'm like, hey, come on, man, chill out. Just kidding. Of course, we all get stressed, and probably drinking all the coffee we drink doesn't help. So it was good to have a relaxing time. So now we can start to start at a mellow level and increase our stress. Will probably start going up before. But at least I have a few days before mugs are going to start flying around the office again. But the Congress is going to be so much fun. The reason why we it's getting so hectic because we've really tackled a lot here. We're putting on a lot of different events. We've got something like 28 speakers. And this is a combination of people speaking together or doing some Q&A and stuff like that. Something like 28 or 29 speakers coming to this thing, fitting them into 5 days. It's going to be just this wild roller coaster of ufological education. And, I mean, if you're a skeptic, if you have a family member that's a skeptic, bring them to the conference, because I don't know how you can go through this thing and come out the other end being skeptical still. We've got all of these military people being that are talking. We've got, you know, with their personal experiences with UFOs. In one case, someone touching this strange craft on the ground. And some of these are officers. In fact, we have the highest ranking military officer who had an experience who is talking right now, and that's a colonel. We have Paul Hellyer, of course, who is the defense minister of Canada. I mean, he was working for the prime minister there. That's big time. He'll be there talking about his experiences. It's going to be very exciting, and the rooms are booking. I told you guys, and I think some of you listened to me, to book your rooms early, which you've done. And so the main hotel is almost all booked up. But luckily, there are more hotels in this town of Fountain Hills. I was excited because I was thinking this is going to be really fun, how we're going to have this whole hotel to ourselves and we're going to take it over, and it's going to be like this UFO event where we're all hanging out with each other and everybody in the hotel is a UFO person. But now it's getting bigger than I expected. Now we're taking over the whole town of Fountain Hills. So, you know, now we're having people book hotel rooms in these other hotels that are just around the corner, free shuttle away. And so now we have the whole town. So this is kind of fun. This is going to be like Telluride or something, you know, like these film festivals where everybody's coming to this little pretty beautiful town with all of these nice amenities and taking over the town, but for UFOs. So this is really awesome. It's UFO Town in Fountain Hills. We're taking it over. So don't worry. Like I said, you know, if you need some advice, if for some reason you call and the hotel is booked, let us know. We'll get you to some of the other places. Really nice hotels out there. They're all really nice, and there's shuttles that go back and forth. So it's not going to be a problem. You're going to have a blast no matter where you are. And just last week, too, this is exciting. We had in a gentleman who is a Hopi Indian, and he is helping organize all of the artists that go out that come to the Fort McDowell area. So he's going to have, we're going to have a lot of Hopi artisans that are going to be there selling their stuff. So we're going to have a strong Native American presence, which is always wonderful. And for those of you who are from like the East Coast, you know, you don't live out here in the Southwest like we do. We see all this beautiful artwork all the time. It'll be a real treat for you because you're going to be able to come here and meet those artists, meet some of the Native Americans and talk about their work and purchase some really nice stuff there. So this is going to be a lot of fun. And we've talked about the film festival that's related to this. And luckily, we've gotten a lot more entries for films as well. So if you have an entry, you got to get that to us real quick. In fact, it might have closed already. But get those films to us real quick. Call us tomorrow if you have a film you want to enter and let us know, because we got to get those in real soon here. But we've got a lot of great entries, and so that's going to be a lot of fun as well. And we've got the new EBE statuettes being created right now. And I hope, you know, they were going to try to incorporate some anti-grab technology in them. So, and telepathic. You've heard of remote control, those helicopters you see in the mall that they're flying around. Think of these statues having an anti-grab sort of propulsion, and you control it with your mind. That's where we're headed one day. It might be 10 years from now, but one day we're going to get these little statuettes to fly. So that's what's going on in Open Minds World. We have a lot going on, a lot of fun. And in the rest of the world, they're UFO crazy as usual, and we've got a lot of UFO news that's gone on in some of the some headlines in the regular conventional media. And we have this extraordinary fellow named Jason McClellan here to share with us some of those UFO headlines. Jason, how are you, buddy?
Hello, Alejandro, and greetings, everyone. This is your Open Minds News Brief for Monday, January 3rd, the first Open Minds News Brief for 2011.
Nice.
In 2010, the newly discovered planet Gliese 581g was announced to be a good candidate for extraterrestrial life. Now, researchers are saying the same thing about another planet in the Gliese 581 solar system. According to new atmospheric modeling research, the planet Gliese 581d, like its neighbor Gliese 581g, may lie in the star's habitable zone, the region where a planet's temperature can sustain liquid water on its surface. The new research supports similar studies conducted earlier in 2010. So, Alejandro, it looks like the Gliese 581 solar system is the place to be if we're going to find extraterrestrial life.
I always think about it, especially watching like nature, you know, and all the diversity of the animals on this planet. I can just imagine the animals on other planets. It's got to be extraordinary.
I can't even start to imagine it.
And the beautiful green
women. Green women?
Star Trek.
Okay. I can say the green women were probably beautiful.
Yep, that'll be wonderful to visit.
This was big news. Previously, secret documents relating to UFOs were released by the New Zealand Defense Force a couple weeks ago. More than 2,000 pages of UFO documents were released by New Zealand's government in response to the public pressure of requests under Freedom of Information laws. The documents contain eyewitness accounts dating back to the early 1950s, including reports from airline passengers, pilots, Air Force personnel, and even a New Zealand prime minister. Many of the reports contained in these files include sketches of UFOs and extraterrestrial beings, but the most detailed reports are from pilots who reported mysterious lights or objects in the sky. Now, people got really excited about the release of this information, but it's important to point out that New Zealand says they didn't actually investigate any of these sightings. They just collected the sightings.
Right.
It's interesting that these would be classified documents if they're not doing anything with them and not supposedly not taking them that seriously, but obviously they did to classify them. But the thing I found the most interesting about the release of these files is they contain information that the response, the letter response or email response to the people submitting the sighting reports, they responded to every single one, and they responded in a very professional manner.
Mm-hmm.
Not in some of these things sounded pretty ridiculous.
Yeah.
But the responses were always, thank you, that's a very interesting sighting. That's a very interesting image or sketch you sent us. Thank you very much. We'll look at it.
It's kind of like the UK files. They were kind of similar because they had a lot of responses in there where they were very polite. But unfortunately, the responses were similar, such as, you know, if it was something ridiculous, it'd be very polite. Oh, thank you for your report. We didn't find anything that would be of defense interest. But then when the sightings were extraordinary, like pilots reporting the giant triangle that flies at them, or they have to steer their plane off course to get out of the way of this thing, they give the same response. Well, thank you for your report, but we didn't find this to be of defense significance. So it's interesting. It's great that they're putting this stuff out. But I wonder, of course, just like with all of these cases, some of them do seem to be of concern. So I wonder if they did have some documents that are still secret on some research that they actually did conduct.
I wouldn't be surprised if that's the case. And there was a very broad range of things contained in these files, you know, from types of extraterrestrial beings, encounters with extraterrestrial beings, chemtrails, just a variety of things. It was fun to look through them, and there are some pretty cool illustrations in there too.
Yeah, we'll have it up soon. We'll write something about this, but you can look into it. And what's interesting, one of the skeptics from Discovery News even wrote, you know, that this is a case that he's interested in. But the Kaikoura case, there was a lot more on this case, and this is a really good case of some pilots who had some sightings out there. So the Kaikoura sightings are really interesting, and we don't have a story up on that now, but we'll get one up really soon.
In other news, Stanley Fulham, a retired Royal Canadian Air Force captain and UFO researcher, died at the age of 87 on December 19, 2010, after reportedly losing a battle with cancer. Fulham gained recent attention with his book, Challenges of Change, in which he predicted several UFO appearances. One of these predictions stated that UFOs would appear over several major cities on October 13, 2010, and because of this prediction, Fulham has been given credit by some for the UFOs that appeared over New York City on October 13. He made other predictions about sightings that will supposedly happen this month, first in Moscow, then in London.
Yeah, we'll see if he's right. It's unfortunate he passed away, but I know he's been sick for some time. In fact, some people speculated that he started talking because he was sick. But if you go read his writings, I mean, he had a lot to say. He had a lot of channeling that he was doing and speaking with extraterrestrials and things like that.
Well, this guy had an interesting work history, too. He worked for NORAD. And
yeah, he actually did.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But again, you know, I think we said it before, but I think people sort of unfairly give him credit for the New York sightings when his prediction actually stated that UFOs would appear over
Multiple
major cities around the world or something.
And that's still a controversial sighting because, of course, the video that was taken does look like it was balloons and at the fear of, you know, our chat room lit up when we talked about that last time. But it does seem like, you know, there were supposedly many reports from people around town seeing other things. So maybe there were other
UFOs. Certainly possible there were multiple things in the sky during that October 13th sighting. But, and again, about these Moscow and London predictions for this month.
Yeah.
Again, I mean, more than likely there will be sightings in both Moscow and London because there always are.
In both towns, there's a lot of sightings.
It's safe to say that this month you'll have a sighting in Moscow and then in London.
Yeah. So I can predict right now there will be sightings next week in Tucson and in Phoenix.
I think you're probably right with that. I doubt you'll be given credit, though.
Dang. No fair.
A couple weeks ago, the Russian news site Pravda reported that the U.S. organization SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, had released a statement announcing the detection of three giant spaceships heading towards Earth. These ships will supposedly reach Earth in December 2012. Dun, dun, dun. It's unclear but probable that Pravda got this information from an Examiner.com article that was published back on December 8th, which cites a SETI astrophysicist as the source of the information. But the astrophysicist cited doesn't seem to even exist. Just one of the several red flags that makes this story seem completely fabricated.
Mm-hmm. And which one of them? Oh, it was the Bad Science? guy from one of the major news.
Bad Astronomy.
Yeah, Bad Astronomy. Yeah. Can't forget. I can't remember which site he writes for. I don't think it's something like Discover or something.
I think it's
like
Discover.
That.
Yeah.
But yeah, he had friends in SETI, and he investigated this to find that this guy didn't exist at all. So
yeah, there was a lot of talk back and forth about whether or not this guy actually existed at mm-hmm. SETI. So he's friends with Seth Shostak, a senior astronomer at SETI, and Seth actually checked with the human resources at SETI, and they had no record of this guy.
Mm-hmm.
And they said it's possible he was an intern here or something, but he's definitely not an astrophysicist here at SETI.
Yeah.
So,
which is good because I don't want 3 UFOs to come here and blow us up in December 2012.
I don't either. And I think that's sort of convenient that this story claimed the December 2012 as the target date these ships would arrive.
Especially now because the movies that we're hearing about aren't coming out until after 2012. And I want to see some of these movies. I think The Hobbit. I need to see The Hobbit, and that's not coming out till like 2013.
And I think it's a bunch of 2012 hype and people making up stories. It's unfortunate. And this is a story that got a lot of major press.
Yeah.
A lot of people latched on to it. It spread around. Then, of course, they have to report that, oh, we found out that this guy doesn't even exist.
Mm-hmm.
People who have examined, worked on Hubble images, have looked at these images of these so-called spaceships, and they're just image defects.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of gives a bad name to any
research. Just people have to be a little more careful. It's interesting because I was watching Fred Burks and his talk from he's an examiner, the intelligence examiner, and he was talking about how you just have to be really careful with these things, Just take it all with a grain of salt. But his point being that even if it looks real, it could be disinformation, so it's hard to tell.
It is hard to tell.
Mm-hmm.
Hundreds of witnesses reported seeing strange lights in the sky above Alista, the capital of Russia's southern republic of Kalmykia. Some witnesses described the lights as a triangle of rotating circles, while others described the lights as looking like two circles rotating clockwise and counterclockwise. The lights reportedly appeared every 10 days during the month of December, but local journalists think the lights are simply spotlights over a shopping center, though they are not sure. We've reported several stories from Kalmykia in the past, primarily due to the former president of the republic, Kirsan Ilyumzhinov, who claims to have met with extraterrestrials back in 1997. And Ilyumzhinov is in the process of writing a book about his experience.
Mm-hmm. Ilyumzhinov.
Ilyumzhinov.
See, I can say it now, but not all the time, and I've been practicing. But you really got that name down real good, Ilyumzhinov.
Well, I think you have Kalmykia down better than I do.
Yeah, Kalmykia. I love to say that.
Argentina's military is going to record and investigate UFO sightings. The Commission for the Investigation of Aerospace Phenomena is in the process of being formed by Argentina's Air Force. The Argentine Air Force already documents UFO sightings, but this new commission will include reports from meteorologists, air traffic controllers, and civilian pilots.
Yeah, this is even more exciting. This is one of the stories like France or something. This is more exciting than a lot of these countries coming out and saying, oh, here's some files. We didn't think much of them. Or like the UK, pretty much putting out some files, some of them very extraordinary, and saying, oh, this isn't real. But Argentina is saying that they have a real concern, and they're putting together a board to actually investigate UFOs. They're going to do actual
investigations. You're absolutely right. This is something that's happening now. It's current, and they are going to investigate these sightings.
Yep, confirmed with their PR. Even Antonio wrote a story for our website where he confirmed with the Argentinian Air Force press department.
Yep, that's right. Yeah, do go to openminds.tv and check out that article by Antonio Hunez. Here's an interesting story that you brought to my attention today, Alejandro. Sort of an entertainment story. The UK trio Muse wants to be the first band to perform in space. In an interview with UK newspaper The Sun, the band has stated that they plan to speak with Sir Richard Branson, head of Virgin Galactic, about the possibility of performing aboard a future Virgin Galactic flight.
Yeah, that's exciting. When I read that, I thought, that's genius. And now's the time to jump on this because it's possible. They even said, we don't know how we're going to get an audience out there. But you know what? Don't worry about that. Just get it down that you were the first people to rock in space. Take your guitars, take an acoustic, and do a little acoustic jam just for each other.
They were even commenting that their setup is so complex and just over the top they were going to have to figure out how to scale back to be able to get all their gear into space.
Yeah, because they're super electro and electronic and all of this stuff. But how cool. That's the race that I'm excited about. Now we've gotten in space. The X race is done. You know, now we have these companies that can go to space. But who is going to be the first band to rock
concert
in space?
That's awesome.
Just to play. I almost want, like, who are the German guys that did those cool anime videos?
That's something Alejandro would know.
Yeah, I know, and I can't remember right now. Well, call in. If you know the German band who did the animations of the guys rocking in space, call in, and we'll send you a free video of Volume 1 of Open Minds Investigates.
You're a funny guy. Let me close out the news with a story about a photo. An interesting photo was taken near Bridport, England last Tuesday. The photographer was shooting the setting sun with his iPhone's camera. When he was saving the pictures to his computer, he noticed a strange object in the sky. He thought that it might be the moon, but the moon wouldn't have been in that particular position in the sky at that time. Some who viewed the photo speculated that the object was simply a reflection of a light in a room behind the photographer. But according to the photographer, that's impossible because he was outside in a field when he snapped the photo.
Oh, I know. I saw that. Yeah, that was obviously someone out in the field. I mean, it's possible it's the moon like they thought, but it's an interesting picture.
Lens flare is one of the more likely candidates.
Especially outside when it's cold, if you got fog on your lens.
And the iPhone cameras do funny things sometimes.
Yeah.
But it does. When it zoomed in, it looked like a lampshade with a light in it.
It did. And normally I would say, you know what, they probably got it. But they were clearly outdoors in that picture. So
right.
That's probably not it. Because that happens a lot, you mm-hmm. know, with these photos. When you're indoor, you have to be careful about that.
Yeah, it's a cool photo. It's interesting for sure. Be sure to check out these stories and more at openminds.tv, your source for UFO-related news. I'm Jason McClellan, your Open Minds news correspondent, and you've been briefed. Back to you, Alejandro.
Thank you, Jason. So interesting news out there, and I'm not kidding. I remember the name of the band now. That's electronic music. There's these animation videos where they have this adventure in space, this band. They're like the Japanese anime. And I remember the name of the band, but I'm not going to say it. If you give us a call, we're like 1-800-UFO-0110. And or you send us an email, the first to do that and name this band, we'll send you a free DVD, which is a good thing to mention. We did put together a DVD with some of our investigations. 1-877-UFO-0110 is the number. I repeat, 1-877-UFO-0110. But this DVD with some of our investigations expanded. I mean, you can see some of these investigations on our YouTube or on our website and our videos, but we've expanded those and put this whole thing together in a whole package where we have five different cases that we put together, some exclusive footage from Roswell and exclusive interviews that we've done on a variety of topics. So it's a pretty cool DVD, and you can go purchase that right now in our store. But I'm going to give you a clue, people. Wait a couple days. Because it's going to go on sale. You're going to see a message on, don't tell anybody I told you about this sale on the DVD. But it's a very cool DVD. You're going to like it. A lot of fun. Some of the other stories from the website. Oh, no, somebody chatted me an answer, I think, but I can't read it. Because sometimes the chat does that, and it's all like weird characters. So, Del Pittman. Try to change your font, and maybe I can read it. But some of the other stories going on. Oh, that's so weird. Someone said, I think the band is Godzilla, but that's not true. But right before the show, I was singing the Godzilla theme song, and we were listening to it. Oh, and then there's someone else, Me Laughing Chariot, who's really close. Oh, guys, you're almost there. But yeah, this Argentina story we wrote. Sure, other people have mentioned some things about Argentina and about the Air Force doing some investigations. However, we've got the most researched story on Argentina out there. So check it out. Antonio, of course, has a vast knowledge of South America and all of the ufology that goes on down there. So we put some history in there and some of the really cool sightings that they've had in Argentina. And like I said, he contacted the Air Force himself, the press department, and was able to confirm some of this. So read our story. It's a really good one. We've also got all the other stories that Jason talked about on here. And just today, we posted a story on an Argentina UFO photograph that was taken in 1974. A pretty cool photograph. It comes from the Wendell Stevens archives, which we dive into and we're scanning and we're putting on the internet for you all so that you can see all of that stuff that he collected. And this is this really interesting photograph from 1974. I thought since Argentina is such a big deal right now, you guys would want to check that out. And I want to mention this real quick. Another thing to check out on the website that's going to be brand new tomorrow is a resource tab. So now we're going to have a tab because we have a lot of cool stuff that we want to get out there. And instead of photos, you're going to see a tab that says resources. Under this tab, you're going to be able to look at the photos. There'll be a link to our YouTube, but there'll also be a link to the Wendell Stevens archives. So you can go click that and see all of the stories that we've put up of his archives, and that'll populate itself when we continue to put stories up like we did today. And you'll also be able to see some of the memorials, but we have more coming. We have exclusive documents. Some of these documents have never been posted on the internet before. Dozens and dozens of them that we're going to be getting up onto the internet. So check out that resources tab. We'll tell you more about when we post stuff on the radio show, and we'll write stories and send out emails on that as well. So, but without further ado, let's get to our spectacular guest today, and that is the one and only Mr. Travis Walton. Travis, are you there?
I'm here.
Yay. How you doing?
All right.
Good. I'm getting really excited about the conference coming up here. Excited to see you again.
I'm getting emails from people from all over that are planning on attending.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. And like I told people, you know, it's a chance to get to meet you. Which to me, to you, that might not be exciting. But to me, it was when I first met you. It'll be exciting to a lot of the other people out there. So let's start talking about your experience. And I guess for those who don't know much about it, maybe we'll talk about where it was and when it was.
I was right up here in northern Arizona back in 1975. It was November 5th. I was working in the woods with a crew of six other men. And
In the movie, you know, there's this. They show you in like this really heated kind of relationship that you had with one of your coworkers who came with you that evening. Was that true? I mean, was there someone that, I mean, you guys were really going at it or didn't like each other?
Well, we had our moments. There, you know, it's just like any crew of guys. We weren't a bunch of buddies, you know.
Yeah.
We were just people who were together for a job and
right.
Our differences at time. And, you know, there'd been fights between some of the other guys on the crew at different times. But, you know, basically, it was just a crew of guys that were there for the purpose of work. So, you know, a lot of people, you know, were shocked that the crew wasn't more heroic, you know, when I was hit. But it's perfectly understandable, you know, even had we been buddies, that, you know, them seeing what had happened to me and thinking that it had killed me, it was completely understandable that they would, take
right.
off because they were next.
Right, exactly. I mean, you never know how you're going to react to something until it happens. And
yeah, I know. And a lot of people imagine they would be real heroic, you know,
right.
They would go out and save somebody. But, you know, under the circumstances, it was a very terrifying experience. And
Well, so let's get into it. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, let's get into that then. So you all leave work, and I guess you carpooled, so you had a truckload of people. And
yeah, it was a double cab truck. You know, it was big enough to hold all seven of us, and we hadn't been driving very long. See, in the movie, it kind of gave the impression that, you know, it was a long drive home and everybody was getting kind of drowsy. But the truth was, we'd just barely been physically working hard. And you know, so we weren't sleepy. Our minds were, you know, pretty keen because of the recent physical exercise, you know.
Right. And so then you're going home and it gets dark, and that's when you spotted something?
Yeah. You know, at first it wasn't all that alarming, but the longer we looked, the stranger it was. It was deer hunting season, and we'd been hearing a few shots in the distance. So it wasn't, you know, it's much of a stretch to think, well, what, the light was probably maybe some deer hunters camped out there. But then, you know, it became more evident as the longer we looked that that the light was coming from higher than where the crest of the ridge would have been. And, you know, like I said, not all that alarming at first, but still something definitely out of place. You don't normally see a light off in the woods, you know, it's usually pretty dark. And, and so, you know, it wasn't like we all immediately started talking about it either. It's just kind of everybody, you know, was kind of divided up into little conversations that were going on, and then one by one everybody kind of quit talking and kept looking in the same direction, and people were saying, well, what, you know, wondering what that was. So
then you guys decided to go check it out.
Yeah, well, you could see ahead where the light was breaking through washing across the road ahead, so we knew when we got up there we'd be able to see the source of the light.
Oh, so you didn't have to go off course to go actually check it out. It was on the, it was just off the path that you were headed on your way home anyway.
Yeah. So as soon as we got to where that light was, we could see the craft hovering there. And it was unmistakable. And I think it was Alan Dallas yelled out, it's a flying saucer. And, you know, like anybody needed to say, because it was so clear. This is less than 100 feet away, you know. This huge metallic disc hovering there below the treetops and outlined against the sky and giving off this very strange light and making this really weird sort of very complex sound.
Mm-hmm.
Really high and really low. Off the range of human hearing on both ends.
So, and then I think the movie title came from how you described this craft, that it was like a fire in the sky?
Yeah, you know, even before we got up to it, we were thinking that maybe it was a forest fire, but it was just kind of a passing thought because, you know, we have driven through the woods and come upon a tree that had been hit by lightning that was burning. You know, you stop and put the fire out. So, but, you know, it had been clear, dry weather, and so that was quickly, you know, dismissed as a possible source of the light. And you know, when we described it as looking like molten metal, we were talking about like metal from a blast furnace, you know, that's almost white hot, you know, kind of a really brilliant yellowish glow. And so, you know, in the movie, they made it look like molten lava, kind of red, and actually a cooler color than it was. And but that wasn't the way it was. It was really easy to see distinctly the surface of it. It wasn't so bright that you couldn't look directly at it. It was metallic all over, but parts of it were glowing. Panels, but everything was smooth. There wasn't any like seams or anything. It was almost like glass. The whole thing was perfectly smooth.
Yeah, the picture that I've seen that you had put together, I think Mike Rogers, one of the other witnesses, had, it looks almost like it's a mirrored.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's kind of like, you know, when light's coming in through the window and you're looking at the television, which, of course, is giving off light, but you can still see things reflected in the screen. So you could see the surrounding trees reflected in the surface of this craft. At the same time, it was giving off a glow that kind of made everything around close to it look really kind of weird. A soft sort of a glow that just kind of made things look odd.
So people were getting pretty scared, but how were you feeling?
Well, I was scared, but, you know, I thought it was going to take off before I got very close. So, you know, I was really curious to see it up close and, you know, maybe a little bit of showing off in going so close to it. But I regretted that pretty quickly. I started out moving rapidly towards it, but then when I saw that it wasn't taking off, see, you know, when we're riding home in the woods, you know, you'll see a deer or a bear or something, and you'll call for the rest of the crew to look, and very often before they can even turn and look, it's gone before they get a chance to see it. So that was kind of my thinking, that it would be gone before I got that close. But the closer I got, and it wasn't going anywhere, and the more alarmed the crew was getting, you know, they started yelling at me to get back in the truck and swearing at me. And
why'd you decide to get out, just to get a closer look?
Yeah, I was curious. You know, I just wanted to see it before it zipped off. And Steve Pierce, he was saying that Alan Dallas was, you know, ducking down on the floorboard. And Dwayne Smith put it, was, he said he kissed his knees. But, you know, I guess he was trying to get down below the sill of the truck, you know, for a little better safety. But it was really pretty scary for everybody, including me. You know, I was trying not to act scared, but, you know, when it suddenly started to move and started to get louder, I dove for cover. There was a log sticking up out of this pile of logging debris that they'd piled up there. And I got down behind that. And, see, as I was approaching, you know, I finally got close enough to where I was looking up at a pretty steep angle. Probably steeper than 45 degrees. I know, I'm not sure, but and then when it started to move and it started to rise up and it was kind of unsteady as it rose. And then the guy of the crew were really, you know, in a panic and yelling at me to get away from there. But, you know, I didn't really need to be told. I was figuring out, you know, how am I going to get myself out of this situation? And, you know, it didn't take long to figure out, just jump up and run back to the truck. But when I raised up at that point, you know, I was closest to the craft. So, you know, maybe that triggered something, whatever happened. As soon as I straightened up, I was just felt this numbing shock, kind of like I'd been hit real hard physically or maybe electrocuted. Dwayne Smith later became an electrician, and he said to him it sounded like high voltage. But, you know, in one of the police interviews, one of the men said it looked like a long blue flame, but whatever it was extremely powerful. You know, Steve Pierce says that he thinks it threw me like 20 feet. Some of the other crewmen say it was like 10 feet, but Steve swears it's 20 because he's out there now talking about this. I hadn't heard from him in like 30 years, and he suddenly started writing.
Hmm.
But anyway, it was pretty violent. And, you know, how Hollywood likes to embellish things.
Right.
In this case, they've actually kind of played it down.
Really?
In the movie, it kind of looks like a spotlight came on and the actors kind of held there for a second and then tossed back. But the crew said it was more like I'd stepped on a landmine, like a grenade had just gone off and just blew me through the air. And they say the way my body tumbled and the way I hit the ground without defending myself from the fall, that they figured he'd killed me. You know, that they actually yelled out at each other, he killed him, he's dead.
Just like in the movie. Someone asked, the size of the craft in the movie, was that similar to real life?
Well, it's kind of hard to gauge, mm-hmm. you know, size even in the movie. When you're out in the woods, there's not that much of a reference. You know, you don't have anything familiar size objects to compare it to, but just judged on the size of the clearing later, you know, we figured maybe 25 feet in diameter,
mm-hmm.
which isn't really all that huge, but when you see that thing up close and feel that powerful sound, it really had a very imposing sort of a feel to it.
And so when this, like you said, it was one person said like a blue flame that came out, hit you, and you flew 20 feet, and that's when your coworker said, "Ah, kill them, and we're out of here."
Yeah, they said they just panicked and took off, nearly wrecked the truck, trying to put some distance between them and the craft, and they got up a ways, and then they saw some deer hunters, and they went and tried to catch them, hoping that maybe they had some weapons, but, you know, I guess they finally came to their senses and calmed down a little bit and realized they were going to have to go back and see what happened. And so, you know, you got to give them credit for that, because
I think definitely, you know, I think especially, you know, you watch war movies and when something happens, you know, when something as powerful happens as that, I think it's brave of them that they decided to go back at all right that soon.
Yeah. And, you know, in the movie they had it where, you know, when Mike pulled over and said, "Look, you know, this truck's going back and anybody that doesn't want to go can wait here. And anybody who wants to go with me can go." In the movie, Mike went back alone, which is just ridiculous because there's no way that any one of those crew is going to get out and stand alone in the dark out there on that road.
Yeah.
You know, it might have been pretty apprehensive about returning, but you know, they all went back.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got to give them credit for that because they had every excuse to keep going and straight to the sheriff. But
how long was it before they went back? Was it very much?
It wasn't very long. They said it was, you know, just long enough to run up there and try to catch those hunters. And then when they couldn't, they turned around and went back. And they thought they saw the light moving off through the trees. And so that made it a little easier, but they were still pretty scared getting back to the site. They could see where the truck had peeled out when they took off, and so they found the spot, and they said they were pretty apprehensive about getting out. They only had one flashlight, so they were all, you know, six of them huddled around this one flashlight and searching, where my body had landed, you know, there was nothing there. So they called out, and they were, you know, continually being scared by the moon, because it was kind of similar in color, catching sight of it through the trees, you know, as the craft. But, you know, it was pretty intense, and at one point, you know, Mike broke down and cried. And, of course, right now, Steve Pierce is making a big deal out of that, you know, because he felt so bad about, you know, my first book, when I wrote about, you know, he was one of the ones that was still crying when they went to the sheriff. He didn't like that at all.
Oh, no.
Some of his relatives were teasing him about it or something. Mm. You know, here we are 35 years later, and he's working on a book, and his main issue is he wasn't the only one crying, and
right.
Alan was so scared. And, you know, I don't think anybody cares,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, to him, it's the biggest issue out there, is that, you know, he wasn't that scared, and the other guys were crying too. And, you know, I don't feel, you know, that any of those guys have anything to be ashamed of.
Right.
In how they handled it, you know?
Yeah, you see someone, what you think is someone being killed right in front of you.
Yeah.
It's very traumatic.
Yeah, it was very traumatic, you know, and I suppose probably all of us have cried about it in one way or another since it happened. But, mm-hmm. you know, it's just one of those things you have to deal with. And
mm-hmm.
yeah, we're a bunch of tough loggers, and, you know, I don't like to emphasize that part of it. But, you know, it speaks to the intensity of what we experienced.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they went back to town and they were arguing about what to do. Alan Ballas didn't want to go to the authorities yet, you know. He preferred just to get some friends and some guns and go back and make a search. And then if they couldn't find me, maybe, you know, then go to the sheriff. But, you know, Ken and Mike figured, no, because, you know, if Travis is never found, and it's going to look bad if we don't report it right away. So, you know, they were of the opinion that they should report it right away. So they did. They called the local deputy, and he called the sheriff, and he brought another deputy with him. And so, you know, the sheriff interviewed the men right there. And like I said, you know, some of the guys were still crying. And the lawmen were really impressed with the fact that something really serious had happened.
Mm-hmm.
But being lawmen, they figured that they were suspicious right away. We found out later that these guys had killed me,
mm-hmm.
that there'd been some kind of fight at work, and that they were just making up a crazy story to cover up for why nobody was ever going to see Travis again, you know?
Right.
So, but, you know, people ask him, did it look like they were drunk or something, you know? And the sheriff says that, you know, he sat in the truck with him and interviewed him right after it had happened. And you know, he didn't spot anything. And, you know, he's got a long career in law enforcement. He says, I didn't see anything and I was looking.
Yep.
So,
So they go back, and I think there's even a manhunt where they're looking for you for 5 days, and
yeah, in the movie, the sheriff didn't want to go out that night, but in actuality, he took part of the crew with him, and they made another search, went back out there,
mm-hmm.
and again, that took courage. Of course, it took a little less courage because the sheriff and his men were armed.
Yeah,
but still. You know, I don't really think conventional weapons would have helped them too much.
Yeah.
But still, you know, they did go back and they did try to rescue me, and I give them credit for that. But they were unable to find anything that night, and so the sheriff organized a massive manhunt. He got the search and rescue parties and volunteers from the Forest Service and civilians. And, you know, there were people on horseback and four-wheel drive vehicles. They basically, you know, spaced the people out over a wide area and moved through the woods in unison so that, you know, each searcher was in sight of another searcher. And they just, you know, crisscrossed and combed the area that way in a very organized way, and were unable to find, you know, any kind of sign of any kind. The tracking dogs were unable to find anything beyond the clearing. On the credits of the movie, there's a credit for Geiger counterman, and that scene wasn't actually used in the movie.
Hmm.
They didn't want to put anything in the movie that weighed too heavily in favor of this actually happening. They wanted to preserve for the audience the idea that maybe these guys had killed me, you know.
Mm, for the suspense of the movie.
Yeah. So they took that out and threw in some clues against it, like that tabloid in the truck, which never happened. And you know, even the thing about Mike going back alone didn't happen. It was just
uh-huh.
all to put doubt on it, and, you know, who killed who and, you know, what might have happened here. So... there were some other scenes that were shot that weren't used. You know, Hollywood has to kind of sex things up, you know.
Before you had come back, was it true that the police did start to suspect foul play?
Oh, yeah. They were being accused more and more openly. During the search, one of the Forest Service volunteers walked up to one of the crewmen and grabbed his shirt front and jerked him up close and said, "All right, where'd you hide the body?" Because, you know, that was kind of the attitude a lot of the searchers had, that they were mad that they were even being put through this, because they figured these guys had killed me and just a cover-up. So, but that's when the crew said, you know, "We're not lying. We'll take sodium pentothal or lie detector test, anything you want." So the sheriff heard about that and arranged for a lie detector test. He brought in the best in the state, probably one of the best examiners in the country at that time, was Cy Gilson. He was the state police polygraph examiner. He'd been doing all the work for the Department of Public Safety and law enforcement in the state. And so the men went down to the county courthouse, which was also the jail. And
they all passed, right?
Yeah, they all passed. They announced at first that one of them was inconclusive, but we got a copy of the file that showed that, you know, privately they had said that even Alan was basically telling the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, but that didn't stop the disbelievers, you know. Even after I was returned, you know, people were just desperate to explain this away any way they could.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just one theory after another that just didn't make any sense.
So then, I guess, getting to your experience, what was the next thing you remember after being zapped?
Well, I regained consciousness kind of slowly. And I was in a lot of pain, and I didn't even remember how I got there at first. I was in and out of consciousness. And then, you know, it kind of gradually came to me that I was lying on some kind of a raised operating table or gurney of some kind. And I remembered approaching that object, but I didn't think that I was on board. At first I thought, you know, there was this light above me, and I was just thinking that maybe I'd got hurt somehow, and that the crew had taken me to the hospital. So I thought I was in, like, an emergency room, and I was having trouble seeing and having trouble breathing. So it was so intense that I kind of, like, was in and out for a while.
Mm-hmm.
I can hear the sounds of movement around me, and they have this device across my chest. But, you know, I couldn't get my eyes to focus very well. The light, even though it wasn't all that bright, was painful. And I had a lot of pain in my head and chest. But I could kind of make out the forms of people standing around me, moving around, and then when I could finally focus, I could see that this wasn't a doctor. This was this creature standing over me. And I just flipped out. I just instantly figured out where I was and what the situation was. I knew I was in a bunch of trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And I just flipped out. I just completely, I guess I just kind of went crazy with fear.
Mm-hmm. Now, and these creatures, I think you describe them as pretty similar to, just slightly different than what people usually see, these things with big heads, with large eyes, small bodies, and they were wearing some sort of jumpsuit.
Yeah. This was, you know, there weren't a lot of such reports back in those days. So.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think anybody had come up with the term grays or anything like that, so I don't call them grays. Matter of fact, you know, I've kind of accepted the term spacecraft and alien, but tell you the truth, I don't know where they were from.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I try to stick to what I saw, but knowing where they come, that's a big leap because they didn't tell me. I just flipped out and I tried to knock them away from me, but I was so weak I could hardly move. I lifted my arm and went to hit them away, but it was more of a push than anything. And it fell back surprisingly easy. It was a lot lighter than I thought it would be.
And so you actually shoved one of them. How many of them were in the room?
There were three of them.
Okay.
And he kind of fell back into the other one, and I rolled away from him off the table, and that thing they had on my chest fell off. But I was just, riveted on them, and they came around the table like they were coming towards me, and I staggered back until I hit something. And I was up against the kind of a shelf or a workbench there against the wall. And I looked quickly to see what it was. And there was just some instruments, various things scattered out there. And I just grabbed for the biggest thing I could find to fend them off with. And so I lashed out at them with it and started screaming threats. And so they stopped. They were small creatures, hairless, but they had these huge eyes that just seemed to look right into me.
Mm-hmm.
And it was actually the most disturbing point of all my memories of the entire experience is, the way they looked into me in a way that, I don't know, it's really hard to describe what that effect that had on me, but
and you saw some sort of pupils.
Yeah, there was like a pupil and an eyelid. They actually blink, and not simultaneously, but I saw them blink.
Hmm.
I was thinking how I was going to fight my way past them because I just wanted to put more distance between me and them, but the door was on the other side of them. But before I could make a move, they just turned and left.
Did they try to communicate with you at all that you know of?
Unless that stare had something to do with trying to reach into me in some way. But, recently I thought of an idea about why that might not have been working. I used to think that maybe it was just my complete hysteria that kept them from being able to do anything like telepathy. But, what if the fact that I was hit with that beam caused some kind of an injury in my head that kind of interfered with their ability to control me? As a matter of fact, maybe that was why I came to and regained consciousness. That probably wasn't even anticipated by them.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe it had something to do with an injury that kept them from being able to keep me knocked out or whatever, but it's just speculation.
Yeah.
But they left, and they moved kind of. They seemed quicker, real kind of like a scurrying sort of motion.
Hmm.
So people ask me, did they move like robots? But I really don't think that if you could make something technologically that could function in place of a being, that you would see anything like something jerking or making whirring noises or something,
Mm-hmm. Was it kind of a scurry? They were quick?
Yeah, they were quick.
Mm-hmm.
And light and, kind of a scurrying motion.
Hmm. So they ran out of the room, and this room that you were in, of course, in the movie, the craft is all messy, and there's stuff all over the place. Was it like
that? They had it looking all organic, but it was actually very mechanical and sterile and rather featureless. Uh-huh. I didn't even see screws or bolts. Now, it's possible I overlooked a lot of detail because I was in a total hysterical state and panic, but it seemed rather featureless to me.
Yeah.
And they had gone out down this little passageway to the right, so I went to the left. But I took off, with this fear that they were coming after me. But the passageway curved so tightly to the right that I couldn't see far enough behind me to see if they were after me, or even far enough ahead to see if I was running into something worse.
Right.
I was really torn about that little escape that I was making there. But I was just looking for a way out. And I just thought, you know, I guess subconsciously, I wasn't thinking too clearly, but I was thinking if I could just open a door that I would be able to jump out and jump to the ground and be back in the woods.
Gotcha.
So, you know, it's probably a good thing I didn't find a door to open. No telling where it was.
Right.
You know, that could have had serious consequences.
Right.
But that's what I was thinking not too clearly, you know, in doing. But I came to a doorway, and there was a little room, round room there. This little room had some rectangles on the opposite wall that I figured were probably doors. And so I wanted to get over there and see if them were, any of those would open. Now, when I figured out later what the lay of the craft probably was, those doors probably wouldn't have led to the outside anyway, but I was totally disoriented as
yeah.
where I was.
You're just scrambling.
Yeah. When I moved into this room, it darkened, and I could see points of light all around, the floor, the wall, the ceiling. And that was kind of gave me pause, you know, about going any further. But then I realized it had something to do with my position because, you know, the closer I was to the walls, the less you could see that. But when you were near the center of the room, you could see it very clearly, these points of light. So that was either some kind of like a map or a viewing screen of where it actually was.
So you felt these points of light were like a star field?
Like maybe a planetarium type projection.
Uh-huh.
Either, you know, some way of viewing through the walls of the craft where it was, or something projected there.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know where that would be projected from because I never, you know, my form didn't seem to create any shadows or anything.
Mm-hmm.
But I was afraid that somebody would be in the chair. There was a chair in the center of the room, and I avoided that at first. But I wanted to get to those rectangles and see if I could open the door. And I couldn't find any button or doorknob or anything. So I thought maybe the buttons on the chair might open a door. So I tried pushing some of those buttons, which was pretty reckless, but, you know, I was desperate.
What can you lose at this point?
Yeah, but, you know, most of the buttons, unfortunately, didn't seem to do anything.
What did these buttons look like? Like a button on a keyboard or...
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Real flush, smooth, not raised or anything.
Mm-hmm.
Just, you know, technology like you might find on Earth somewhere, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The screen, I didn't touch the screen, so I didn't know if it was touch sensitive or anything like that. But... some of the buttons made the lines move. There was these straight lines, little segments, and they would just kind of change angle and move a little bit, but no numbers or letters or anything I recognized that way. But the one, the, there was a big lever there, and I moved it, and it moved the star pattern.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really disorienting because, you know, these stars were all around me. So it was kind of like my visual reference. And I was unsteady on my feet. I was already a little bit dipped. And so that kind of made me dizzy, and I resolved not to mess with that one anymore.
Right.
But I was thinking about pushing another button, thinking I would open a door. when something caught my attention from the door that I'd come through. And I turned, and there was a human standing there. At least I thought he was a human. And, you know, this was the most welcome sight to me at this point, because I thought somebody was there to rescue me, you know, that this was some kind of police or military or, you know, something, NASA maybe.
What were his clothes like?
Well, he was wearing blue coveralls, mm-hmm. but no insignia, no flags or anything like
that.
Did
the coveralls look strange at all? Were they different from maybe what an Air Force?
Yeah, it was definitely not something that, you know, I wasn't thinking too clearly, but, you know, it was much more close-fitting than you would see in a Air Force jumpsuit. But he had this helmet on, and I was just yelling questions, and he wasn't answering, but I thought because of the helmet that maybe he couldn't hear me or couldn't talk with it on. So when he wanted me to go with him, I was only too glad to go, you know, figuring he was going to take me out of this place.
And the pictures, that looks like the helmet was completely clear, like it was made out of a clear plastic or something.
Well, I think it was probably frosted or maybe fogged up on the back.
Okay.
Backside behind him. But, so I went with him, and he took me out of there. And through what I take was probably an airlock. And I don't know if the craft was there the whole time or if it was just there at this point, but when the other door slid back, it was so much brighter and the air was so much easier to breathe. It was really quite a relief. It was, the light was much more like sunlight, too. And he took me out of the craft, which was parked inside of this huge room, kind of an airplane hangar kind of a thing, because the ceiling had these translucent panels that, you know, sloped down into one wall. So the room was shaped kind of like a quarter of a cylinder turned on its side, and the ceiling and one wall were giving off light. I don't know whether these were light fixtures that gave off light that was like sunlight, or if it was just panels and sunlight was shining on them. I tried to look around, but he seemed to be in a hurry, and he was leading me along, and I was stumbling because I was still pretty weak and unsteady on my feet.
And you said it seemed like a hangar, so it must have been very large.
Yeah, it was very large. It was the ceiling was quite high. And there was some other craft in there, disc-shaped craft. I didn't see any airplanes or anything conventional craft, but these other craft were more rounded and sort of more chrome or reflective-like. But I didn't really get a chance to look that much, so I don't know how many there were exactly. But he hurried me out of this room, in this hangar, down a hallway. And I was getting pretty anxious about why I wasn't getting any information, any answers, you know. But it really put my mind at ease quite a bit to be in his company and away from the creatures and out of that humid, dark place. But then he took me into this room, and there were some other people dressed like him, except they weren't wearing helmets. So I thought, you know, that maybe now they could hear me and they could answer my questions. Well, that's kind of an exaggeration about my thinking, because it wasn't all that clear. I was really kind of foggy-headed and just full of panic.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when I repeated these questions, I was basically yelling and screaming like a maniac. But he left me with them, and they started to try to put me down on the table. And that's when I got suspicious about, was I really rescued? And were these, you know, were they there to help me at all, you know? So I started to try to resist, which didn't do me a whole lot of good because I was still so weak.
And here you couldn't hear anything. So did you get a sense they were trying to communicate with you at all? Were you getting or frustrated that they wouldn't?
Because, see, they were close enough. They had a tight grip on me, and I was struggling. I was too weak to pull loose. But there were three of them, and they were so much stronger than me. And but when I yell, I could see a little wince in their face. So I know they could hear me, but they didn't seem the slightest bit inclined to answer me or, you know, show much emotion or anything.
Right.
I was able to jerk one hand free and get it under the edge of the mask. They put this mask over my face. It was kind of like an oxygen mask, which I think was, you know, something designed to knock me out, because even though I got my finger under it, I just blacked out just that fast. I don't think I fainted. I think it was the mask that did it. But I just went out real fast. And I don't know, you know, where this conscious period was, you know, during this experience, whether it was at the beginning, the middle, or at the end. But
the next thing
I remembered was waking up, and I came to pretty quickly. I was still in quite a bit of pain in my head and chest, but not nearly as bad as before. But it was cold air, and I could tell it was outside. And I was lying face down with my head on my arm, and there was a light above me, and I looked to see where the light was coming from. And I looked up, and I could see the bottom of this craft hovering there. And it seemed like I could feel warmth coming from it. But just as soon as I put my eyes to where the light was coming from, it went out. So I don't know whether the light was like propulsion or a light fixture or hatch closing. But it was just hovered there for a second in the dark. I could see everything reflected in this silvery hull before it just shot up into the sky. Just was gone from sight so fast. It was just incredible. You'd think it would just break the sound barrier or something, but it was basically silent. It kind of stirred the air a little bit, and the leaves and the branches moved. But the next thing, I just went from looking up into the sky and seeing that nothing but stars to looking around, and I recognized where I was. I was standing beside the highway outside the town nearest where this had happened.
And unlike the movie, you had your clothes on also.
Right. That was one of those scenes that they filmed where, you know, I stumble upon these lovers in a car, and they're naked, and I'm naked, and then I start screaming, they start screaming. It was a horrible, horrible scene that they cut, and I'm glad they did. But anyway, I'm still wearing the same clothes I'd been wearing at work, and but it was cold, and I wasn't really thinking about that. I was thinking about getting some help. I ran down across the first bridge, and the first building I came to was lit inside, and there was smoke coming out of the chimney. And so I pounded on the door, and nobody came.
So
I ran on down across the next bridge, and I came to a service station, and there was a row of phone booths there. And I went in and picked up the receiver, and it was dead. And that was really a sinking feeling. But I went into the next one, the middle one, and it worked. But you don't have to have, or didn't at that time, a coin to talk to the operator. So I was able to make a collect call to my family. And first they took it to be some kind of a prank.
Oh, really?
They started to hang up on me.
Wow.
I screamed, "No, it's me, it's me." And for something, and I was able to convince them. And they said, okay, my brother-in-law said, I'll get your brother, and I'll come and get you. We'll come
at
get
this
you.
Time, did you have a sense yet as to how long you had been gone?
No, I thought it was the same night. So when they picked me up, and that was kind of weird, too, because I collapsed there, and it seemed like hardly any time before they were there, but it had to be at least 45 minutes. Anyway, they picked me up and put me in the truck, and I tried to tell them about what happened, and it was just so horrible. I just kept breaking down.
Uh-huh.
Somehow in the conversation, it came out about how much time had gone by. Because I said something, you know, that made them understand that I thought this was still the same night. And they said, no, Charles, feel your face. And I had this growth of beard, and I looked at my watch, and it had changed the date. And man, that, for some reason, really just kind of finished me off, you know?
Yeah.
And so...
one point I want to make, or go ahead.
Well, you know, it had been a pretty rough time.
Mm-hmm.
And the family had been getting all these weird calls. You know, that was part of the reason they were going to hang up on me, is they had a lot of crank calls. But some of the calls sound... Well, you know, this one lady said she was a nurse and she had been working in a hospital, and this old couple had had an experience like what I had experienced. But when she came back on shift, the couple was gone, their records were gone, and everybody was trying to act like they hadn't been there. So
she was
saying, just be careful who gets a hold of him when he gets returned.
Wow.
And they had a call from a guy that said he was retired CIA that said the same thing. So the family was pretty leery about, just taking me off to the sheriff and saying, well, here he is, we found him, you know.
Yeah.
They were, you know, untrusting of the authorities.
Oh, wow. I had not heard of that part before.
Yeah, so rather than taking me right to the sheriff, my brother took me to Phoenix and tried to get some medical tests done right away. And that was kind of interesting. There was quite a battery of tests, but first kind of got diverted to some phony ufologist guy that they sort of represented in the movie. But some rather strange people that weren't who they claimed they were. You know, guy representing himself to be a doctor, couldn't do any tests. But finally got hooked up with the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization. They organized a whole bunch of tests. So I had EKG, EEG, blood tests, urinalysis, upper body x-rays, whole battery of tests that went on. You know, there was additional tests added later, but one of the things that was, you know, people tried to explain it away with right off the bat was that it was all a drug hallucination. So that was the reason these blood and urine samples were put through the county medical examiner's drug screen, showed no trace of any drug. And so the same thing with the theory that I'd had a transitory psychosis, that I'd, you know, temporarily gone insane. Imagine that this had happened to me and then come back to normal.
Right.
Well, the psychiatric test showed a perfectly normal pattern of scores. But, you know, what's really stupid is that all of these theories, and there was another theory that the hypnotist had led me in during hypnosis to believe that this had happened to me.
Yeah.
But none of that squares with how six other men shared my hallucination.
Right.
You know, nothing the hypnotist could have done to me would have had any effect on the rest of the crew. Yeah. The same thing with transitory psychosis. Did the whole crew have a transitory psychosis?
Right.
You know, did they all hallucinate? You know,
right.
It's just totally absurd. Nobody asks the question, how do seven people have the same delusion?
Yeah, before we're done, too, I wanted to make sure people got to hear the full story of what really happened on the craft, because that's the main part that's different from the movie. And I also wanted to clear someone's name, because you hear a lot of times it was the director who did it, the director to change shit, and the director was Tracy Torme, who did not.
No, that was the screenwriter. He
right.
he wrote it. The changes came in later, and I'm not sure who added those changes and or asked that they be made. Mm-hmm. But originally, I agreed to do it with the understanding they were going to stay true to the story. And it's only after, you know, so each person that becomes involved, another co-producer, the director of the studio, and each person gets creative control to a greater and greater degree.
Mm-hmm.
And me, least of all. I never approved those changes. And as a matter of fact, the part aboard the craft where they changed things the most wasn't even in the script that I got. And so, you know, I was really pretty disappointed about that.
Mm-hmm.
And so was Tracy Torme, right? He was very upset about the changes.
Yeah, he was. And he did his best to try to get them to stay with the real story. And he was successful to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm still happy that, you know, although he had to give in on those things, that it did allow people to experience the kind of emotion that we went through living through that back. Because, you know, people still left the theaters with the same kind of emotional impact,
uh-huh.
you know.
Yeah, and, just the sheer fear and terror that you did experience while you were on the craft.
Yeah. And, you know, there's even a few things where I would have to say it did a better job of showing how I felt.
Mm-hmm.
There's this one scene where the actor's face is covered with a membrane and he's struggling to breathe through it. And although that didn't happen at all, you know, if you'd have just showed an actor standing there breathing hard, looking panicked, you wouldn't understand the feeling of suffocation that I had and how that added to the feeling of panic so
gotcha.
Much.
Well, thank you. I mean, we're almost out of time already. Of course, a lot of questions and everything. Oh, one quick question. Someone asked in the chat was, did you ever get visited by any government-type people?
Yeah, there was quite a bit of that on the underhanded. Nothing overt, you know, but I guess I can get into that more if they come to the conference. We can
exactly
any questions we didn't cover here.
We'll tell them or we'll leave them wanting more. I mean, we got the main part, what's different from the movie. But, yes, you'll be at the UFO Congress in February where people will be able to hear more. And thank you so much for being on the show. We'll definitely have you on again, too, so we could get more into some of this other stuff.
Yeah, I'll get back with you, Alejandro.
All right. Thank you so much. I'm excited to see you. And we'll see you in February. It's going to feel like no time, I'm sure, before we're there.
Yeah, just a few weeks away.
Time flies. It's already 2011.
Yep.
All right. Well, tell Danny Happy New Year and Happy Holidays for me, and we'll talk to you later.
Talk to you later.
Thanks. All right, Travis Walton, there's what really happened on the craft, and I think what really happened is so incredibly fascinating. I'm sure you all do, too, and what might have happened and why. But it is important to note that Tracy Torme, who is Mel Torme's son, he was the one who directed the movie, and he did not want to make those changes either. He was very upset about that. He wanted to stay true to the story as well. So it was the producers, these Hollywood types we were complaining about earlier in the show, who changed stuff and thought it would be more exciting if they made up all this weird stuff with human body parts and everything. But that was not the case at all. But yes, if you thought this story was fascinating and you want to get more of a sense of if you feel that it's real or not, you know, come to the conference, UFOcongress.com, and come and meet Travis yourself. You'll find that he's a very down-to-earth person, and you'll be able to hear more about this story. Now, next week, we have another spectacular guest who's also a speaker at the conference, and that is Kathleen Martin. She's actually the niece of Betty Hill. And Betty and Barney Hill were the first abduction case that came to the public attention in 1961. Another very fascinating case way back when. She is now book on that. She does speak, talk. She worked for MUFON for a period of time. In fact, she graded my UFO investigator test. And she's written some books with Stanton Friedman. So we'll talk to her about that, Kathleen Martin, next week. I'm excited about this one, too. You guys have a wonderful week. That's it for Open Minds this week, your UFO news authority. And we will talk to you later. Adios, muchachos.